Does the Civil War live on today? Historian Tim Tyson says it does, in ways you might not expect. Tyson has spent much of his life thinking about America's racial divide, partly because of a chilling murder in his hometown of Oxford, North Carolina, a story he tells in a book called Blood Done Sign My Name. And Strange Champs talked with Tyson about race and the appropriation of history.
Do you think the collective memory of the Civil War is still with us? I mean, is that war still potent to people today?
Well, it certainly is in the South. I think there's a lot of difference between losing a war and winning it. I live in Madison, Wisconsin much of the time, and I've noticed that there are Union monuments there and nobody pays any attention to them. But woe be unto you if you try to move the Confederate monument in a little town in North Carolina.
Certainly in the South, I know the Confederate flag is still a very potent living symbol, whereas I guess, you know, to most Northerners, it's just a historical artifact. Does that suggest that the Civil War's legacy really just matters to people in the South? It's not really important to the North?
Well, I wouldn't say so. I think that in some ways our popular narrative of the Civil War matters to people in the North because it gives them a safe sense of moral superiority. You know, you'll rarely meet anyone from Ohio whose parents weren't abolitionists and didn't actually hide people on the Underground Railroad. Practically every building in Ohio was a way station on the Underground Railroad, apparently, when in fact, of course, white abolitionists in the North were lynched and mobbed and were absolutely unelectable.
And so what people in the North tell themselves, whether or not it's true, is we fought the good fight and we won, and that must be much more complicated for people in the South.
And in some ways, in both cases, it's sort of people sorting through their history after the fact and creating a narrative that they're comfortable with. So that, you know, the Lost Cause in the South, people whose ancestors didn't even support the Confederacy, you know, have rallied around the Confederacy after the fact. I often think about Kinston, North Carolina, where General Pickett, famous of Pickett's Charge, came in 1864, and he hanged 22 local white boys on the courthouse lawn for their loyalty to the United States of America. He hanged them because they opposed the Confederacy. And I imagine their ancestors are driving around, some of them with trucks with Confederate bumper stickers. And I find that interesting that, for example, the Confederate governor of North Carolina, Zebulon Vance, elected in 1864, ran and was elected on a platform of opposition to the war. He said this was a war of the politicians and not the people, and was elected. We act as if somehow white Southerners monolithically favored the Confederacy, which is not true at all.
Then why do you think the legend, the myth maybe, of the Confederacy has lasted so long in the South?
The same reason that the Confederate flag has continued as a symbol, which is white supremacy. In the early part of the 20th century, people North and South came to a kind of sometimes unspoken but often discussed consensus that in many ways the South had been right, that on the bottom was the appropriate place for African Americans, and all across the South, black Americans lost the vote. And really, white domination, legal, cultural, political, economic, was nailed into place, and the cult of the Confederacy rose with this. The Confederate monument in any little town in the South you can point to was put in there in 1909 or 1910 or 1911. It was a signifier.
So not right after the Civil War.
Oh, no. After the Civil War, that monument would have been quite contentious.
I want to talk about the particular piece of racial violence that you know best, that you spent much of your professional life writing about and investigating. In your book, Blood Done Sign My Name, you tell the story of a racial murder that happened in your own hometown, Oxford, North Carolina. When you were just a child, you were, what, 10 years old?
The summer I turned 11, on May 11th, 1970, my friend Gerald Teal walked up in my driveway and said, "Danny and Roger and them shot him a nigger." And he was telling me that his father and his older brothers had murdered Henry Marrow for making what was perceived to be a flirtatious remark to his sister-in-law. And then I remember going down later that evening and seeing the armed men all over Gerald's front porch and walking to school the next day and seeing that there was no plate glass in downtown Oxford. Oxford's a tobacco market town, about 8,000. And we had a big riot the night before, and buildings were burned. We had a murder trial that went on all that summer of 1970, in which Gerald's father and his brothers were acquitted of murder, even though they had committed this murder in public. Blood Done Sign My Name is anything but a murder mystery. That was sort of when the civil rights movement came to Oxford, and we had marches and demonstrations. In the middle of the movement in Oxford, we had a cluster of black Vietnam veterans who met down at the pool hall and made firebombs and burned the tobacco warehouses downtown, you know, fires that you could see for 20 miles, and my family lived four blocks away. So it made quite an impression on me.
Were you frightened?
Oh, yes, I was frightened. Plus, my father was a white liberal, and he was a minister, and he had this crazy idea that we were all God's children, black and white, and that God was no respecter of the color line. And so people were often offering to remodel our house with dynamite, and we ended up having to move away from Oxford.
This marked your family. It marked your upbringing. You grew up, you became a historian, and this has been the subject that you have spent years and years investigating. Why?
Well, partly I just wanted to know what had happened because, you know, this murder and all this violence and this trial and this glaring miscarriage of justice had happened, you know, pretty much in front of my face when I was 10 and turning 11. But then I was in the first generation that integrated schools. And it wasn't easy. A friend of mine was stabbed to death in the bathroom when I was in the 10th grade in a racial fight that he had started. We had riots at school. I wanted to know, what was it that had placed us in this vicious cycle of enmity? Why was it that the black part of town in my hometown didn't have sidewalks and streetlights? Why was it that I didn't know any white people who did yard work for a living? And yet everybody I knew who did yard work for a living was black. Why was it that black women worked in white people's houses doing domestic work? You know, why is that? You know, it was something I needed an answer for.
Why wouldn't the answer be something as simple as it's the long legacy of slavery and of racial attitudes?
Well, that's the answer. But it's far from a simple answer.
Your father was a white liberal minister during all this time, and he was, as you said, doing his best to try to bring blacks and whites together. So presumably you were hearing, you know, a very different message at home than you heard in the community. But the way you write, it's kind of as though that taboo against racial mixing kind of trickled down into people's minds and poisoned people's attitudes toward race in ways that they weren't even aware of. Do you think that was true for you know, you and your family even?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Our white supremacy was unspoken, implicit, unconscious, largely. We were white liberal white supremacists, so we thought it was our job to help the downtrodden and lift up the poor black people, you know, and let them be just like us, you know, with all the condescension that's actually built into that assumption, rather than seeing them as our fellow citizens with whom we might make common ground to move forward together on things that we did agree on, even if we didn't agree on everything. That would be to treat them as equal citizens, just like us. Instead, we were to help them and lift them up, right? So that was our own sort of white liberal version of white supremacy. There was also the internalized white supremacy in the heads of black people that kept them down by persuading them that somehow this was the natural order of things, that somehow they were inferior, that somehow white people were supposed to be in charge of things. So that the movement was never just about getting rid of the Ku Klux Klan, getting rid of the all-white jury, getting rid of the all-white Chamber of Commerce, getting rid of the restrictions on where you could live and where you could work. It was also about stamping out the sense of inferiority that black children grew up in, that the entire world that they grew up in was designed to inculcate in them. Right? All the symbols and signs of their lives had taught them that they were of an inferior caste. And if people accept that assumption, then you don't have to shoot them, right? If you're in the position of the rulers. Right? So that was an internalized white supremacy. You know, and I still find teaching in the Afro-American Studies Department, I still find that brilliant, gifted young African-Americans going into a predominantly and historically white institution, an elite intellectual institution, have to overcome their own sense that maybe they can't cut it.
So this
and some of that is racial.
Just history. This isn't just a piece of the past.
There are young black men killing each other on street corners all over this country over who dissed who. And people, young people who grew up thinking that their lives are worthless enough to be poured out in the crack wars. And that's white supremacy. There are young black people growing up who think that studying, that being a scholar is acting white and betraying their race. That's white supremacy. It doesn't wear a hood and a robe, but it's murderous all the same.
Tim Tyson is a historian at the University of Wisconsin and Duke University. His book is called Blood Doesn't Sign My Name. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him.
We are climbing Jacob.
It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.